this is coming right on the face.
I want this out of the face because that will give it more clear picture. I think this way. That will be better.
This one's okay.
Okay. Let me test. Is my voice carrying to the back? You're not in the back. In the back, is my voice carrying? If you can't hear, well, raise the hand. You can't hear so well. It's all right, okay. Okay, so we start. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everyone. Okay, we continue now with our examination of, in the Buddha's words. And in my last talk, I spoke about the Buddha's view of the human condition and of how this forms the background to the appearance or arising of the Buddha in the world. This gives us a picture of the particular problems that the Buddha's teaching is intended to address. And now, to understand properly and in depth the position of the Buddha in the Nikayas, in the early teachings, we have to view it against this cosmic background that I spoke of in the last part of the last class. The Nikayas give us a picture of a universe of vast dimensions in space and time. As I explained, the cosmic process, according to the Buddha's teachings, unfolds in a rhythmical pattern of world systems arising, expanding, contracting, and dissolving. And each unit in this cosmic process, each whole extent of world expansion, world contraction, is called a kalpa, or kappa in Pali, an aeon. That is the measure of the lifespan of a world system. And the texts tell us that of kalpas that have come and gone, the number is like the grains of sand on the river Ganges. Within this framework of the cosmic process, sentient beings migrate through the course of birth, death, and rebirth. This is what is known as samsara, the cycle of rebirths, the ever-repeating pattern of birth, aging, and death. And what keeps beings tied to this process of migration through samsara is their own ignorance and craving. They are weighed down by ignorance and driven by craving to seek ever new enjoyments, and this pushes them or pulls them from life to life in accordance with their karma, their volitional actions. The arising of a Buddha is part of this cosmic process, part of this pattern. The arising of a Buddha is integral to the cosmic process and also essential in the scheme of liberation that the Nikayas present. The Buddhist texts speak of many Buddhas, not only of Gautama Buddha, but of many past Buddhas. The very early texts in the Nikayas mention six Buddhas preceding Gautama Buddha, the Buddha of the present aeon, and they also speak about a Buddha who's to come in the future called Maitreya, or in Sanskrit, Maitreya. The later texts mention more Buddhas, even increasing the number to 28. And then other traditions speak of hundreds and thousands of Buddhas, all going back through beginningless time. The special function of a Buddha within the cosmic process is to discover the path to liberation from the bonds of samsara, to discover the way out from the suffering of old age, sickness and death, the way that leads to nibbana, the unconditioned reality beyond birth and death. The Buddha not only discovers the path to liberation for himself, but he teaches it to the world. He analyzes it, he propagates it, he expounds it in all of its many aspects. And therefore the texts speak about the arising of the Buddha in the world as the manifestation of great light and great radiance. By teaching the path to liberation, the Buddha enables many others to follow the same path that he discovered and thereby to attain liberation. And so the texts say that a Buddha arises in the world for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of the devas, the deities, and human beings. Before his enlightenment, a Buddha is called a bodhisatta. And this is a word which has been Sanskritized as bodhisattva, a form in which it's better known. But there's an interesting little problem here, which I'll show you, concerned with ancient Indian languages. The Pali form of the word, which would also be the same word used in other Middle Indo-Aryan dialects, is bodhisatta. And now this word satta can be Sanskritized in two ways. One is sattva, which means a being. So the bodhisattva is a being who is seeking enlightenment. or perhaps a being who's destined to enlightenment. But the word Sata could also have been Sanskritized in another way. This would be Bodhisatta. And the word Sata means intent upon, pursuing, devoted to. And so the word Bodhisatta could have been Sanskritized as Bodhisatta, one who is intent upon enlightenment, pursuing enlightenment, or one who is devoted to enlightenment. And we don't know what was the original meaning of the Pali word, what way it was intended to be Sanskritized, but the early translators who translated the Buddhist texts from Pali or from other Middle Indo-Aryan dialects into Sanskrit decided upon sattva, and so the word became bodhisattva. Okay, according to the Buddha's tradition, in order to become a Buddha, a bodhisattva, that is, one intent on enlightenment or one who is seeking enlightenment, has to pass through a long period of preparation, a period that extends over many lives, even over many aeons, fulfilling certain prerequisites. In Buddhist tradition, these prerequisites or qualities needed to achieve enlightenment come to be called paramis or paramitas, a word which means something like excellent virtues. This idea of a bodhisattva fulfilling paramitas is not yet found in the canon, in the Nikayas or other early collections. It first appears in literature from a somewhat later period, perhaps 100 years, literature that starts to appear maybe 100, 150 years after the Buddha's passing, but still in texts which precede the arising of Mahayana Buddhism. In the oldest texts, that is in the Nikayas, the word bodhisattva is used in reference to the Buddha in his immediately prior life, before his last existence as the Shakyamuni. And it also refers to his life in his last existence before his enlightenment. With his enlightenment, with his attainment of Bodhi, enlightenment, then the Bodhisattva ceases to be a Bodhisattva and then becomes a Buddha, an enlightened one. One interesting question that we can raise, referring to the early texts, and that is, was the Buddha's enlightenment something predetermined at his birth, something fixed and inevitable, or was it something that he achieved entirely through the particular circumstances and the efforts of his last existence? I mean, I can't give a definite answer to that, but when we look at the suttas, the Nikaya texts, the answer that seems to be implicit is that he was already predetermined to attain Buddhahood at the time he was born. However, this did not come about arbitrarily by chance, but because in many earlier lives he had already fulfilled the prerequisites for attaining Buddhahood. And so the idea of the Bodhisattva as fulfilling paramitas seems to be implicit in the early suttas, even though this idea is not explicitly stated in the text. One text that seems to me to support this idea that a bodhisattva is already predestined to attain Buddhahood, I've included in the book. It is the text about the Buddha's conception and birth, which begins on page 50. So please open the book. So the passage that I want actually begins on page 52. In his last existence, before descending into the human world, the Bodhisattva dwells in one of the heavenly realms. It's called the Tusita heaven. And he remains there until the suitable conditions appear on earth for his rebirth and for him to undertake that quest for full enlightenment. And so this text tells us in paragraph 6 that mindfully and with clear comprehension, the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb. And then when he passes away from the Tusita heaven and enters his mother's womb, then a great and immeasurable great radiance appears in the world, a radiance that's said to surpass the divine majesty of the gods. Then the earth shakes, quakes, and trembles, the 10,000-fold world system, in fact, shakes, quakes, and trembles, as well as this great immeasurable radiance appearing in the world. And so, since these events happen, they seem to be, you could say, signs, foresigns that he is destined to achieve supreme enlightenment. And then continuing with this account of his birth, in paragraph 16 on page 53, this is Venerable Ananda speaking. He says that when the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first the devas or deities received him, and only afterwards human beings. This is something that I think would not happen with an ordinary child. So this suggests that the being who has been born in this way is somebody who has a great destiny in store for him. So the four deities receive him, and they don't even allow him to touch the earth, but they receive him and then present him to his mother. Then when he comes out from the mother's womb, he comes out pure. He's not sullied by any kind of water, humors, fluids of the body. Then after he's born, two jets of water pour out from the sky, one cool and one warm, to bathe the Bodhisattva and his mother. And then the crowning paragraph, paragraph 20, as soon as the Bodhisattva is born, he stands firmly with his feet on the ground, then he takes 7 steps towards the north. He looks around all the directions, and then he roars the kind of lion's roar, saying, "I am the highest in the world, I am the best in the world, I am the foremost in the world, this is my last birth, now there is no renewed existence for me. And when the Buddha comes out from the womb, again this great radiance appears and the world system shakes and trembles. Now maybe you're going to ask me, did this really happen? It seems unbelievable. And yeah, I say, it's unbelievable. And so I can't say whether this really happened or not. But what's important for us to know is that from the standpoint of the texts themselves, the being who is to become the Buddha is shown to already have this great destiny in store for him. Perhaps some of these incidents are just a way of indicating this, especially taking the seven steps and making that declaration. I mean, it's I'm willing to believe some extraordinary things, but this, I find, stretches my own capacity for belief a little too much. But it can be a symbolic way of indicating the great destiny in store for this being who's born as the Bodhisattva. Okay, along with this elevated conception of the Buddha in the early texts, we also find other suttas that give us what we might call a very human portrait of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva. When we see him engaged in his struggle for enlightenment, he appears as a real man, not somebody who's an exalted saint, somebody who's has to undertake a long, difficult, an intense struggle to attain enlightenment. Even though the suttas give us an account of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment that appears to be straightforward autobiography, these scenes that we read about also have a what we would call a pedagogical function. That means that they are designed or intended to communicate lessons to us. They present the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, as a kind of everyman, an ordinary person in certain ways, though in other ways extraordinary, but an ordinary person who has to undertake this long, difficult, even exhausting journey to find enlightenment and liberation. We see that this journey includes blind alleys and dead ends. And so before he can achieve his goal, he has to proceed in a trial and error manner, trying one method, then another method, then another method, until he will find the correct path on his own. And so in presenting their account of the Bodhisattva's quest for enlightenment, the suttas are also sketching what we might call an ideal model, a paradigm of the universal quest for enlightenment, the same quest for enlightenment that we must also undertake with similar obstacles and similar struggles. There are two main narrative suttas in the early discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya. Actually, there are quite a few, but I've selected two to focus upon. These are Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 26 and Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 36. Both of them relate, in both of them we see the Buddha relating the story of his own quest for enlightenment, but they highlight this quest from different angles, illuminate it from different perspectives. Majjhima Nikaya number 26, we will take first. This sutta begins on page 54. At the bottom. And here the Buddha will be describing his quest for enlightenment as a search for what's called in Pali the Anuttaram Santi Padam. Anuttaram Santi Varam Padam. The quest for the supreme state of sublime peace. And this sutta proceeds by first sketching a contrast between two types of quests. One is the quest in which the ordinary person is engaged in. The text calls this the ignoble search, where we have somebody who himself is subject to birth, aging, illness, and death, and who seeks things that are subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, to sorrow and to defilement. The text mentions the things to which people of that period were attached, wife and children, or we could also add husband and children, men and women slaves, then their livestock, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, then their monetary possessions, gold and silver. We could, of course, change this to our terms more appropriate for our own age, attachment to one's house, to one's car, one's computer, one's other electronic equipment. Okay, then the text will speak about the noble search. And it does this by drawing a sharp distinction, a sharp dichotomy between the worldly preoccupations that normally tie us down and the object of the noble quest, which is Nibbana, Nirvana. The things to which we are usually attached are things that are born, grow old, and die. Things that arise, change, deteriorate, and perish. And the text speaks of these things. The word comes in paragraph 6 to 11. It uses, in English translation, I have these acquisitions. But the Pali word here is very important for getting a good understanding of the early teaching. I write the Pali word on the board. Okay, the word is upaddhi. It comes from the root da, which means to put or to place, and the prefix upa, which has the sense something like upon. So literally upaddhi is placing upon, putting upon. But the word takes on the meaning of the objects to which we are attached, that these become kinds of, these objects become extensions of ourself, where they are the things which support our sense of our own identity, the things that define for us who we are or what we are. At the deepest level, the upadhi are the five aggregates: body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Those are the strongest objects of attachment. But through this attachment to the five aggregates, we extend the range of that attachment to the things of the world, possessions, and relationships that define our identity. Okay, then in contrast with this kind of quest, the noble quest is directed to what is unborn, unaging, free from sickness, to what is deathless, beyond sorrow, beyond defilements. And the shift away from our infatuation with upadhi, with the objects of attachment, the shift away from that attachment to the quest for nibbana comes about. We have the key phrase in paragraph 12. Having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, in line 2 of paragraph 12, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, one then seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Similarly, having understood the danger and what is subject to aging, sickness, death, and so on. Here I'll write this other important word, adhinava. Okay, the word adhinava could translate it as danger, or maybe even deficiency or defectiveness. And this danger or defectiveness consists in the fact that all these objects of attachment are impermanent and insufficient to meet our highest and deepest needs. And this means that they are all ultimately unfulfilling. And as long as one continues to base one's life upon this quest for more acquisitions, for more objects of attachment, then the more one isolates oneself from the fulfillment of one's highest and deepest need. And so when the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, understands the danger or deficiency of things that are subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, things bound up with sorrow and defilement, then he decides to leave them behind and to seek the supreme security from bondage, nibbana. And this is what he calls the noble search. Then in paragraph 14 he shows the impact that this discovery of the Adinava, the danger, had upon him. In the developed story of the Buddha's life that comes later in the commentaries and in the Buddhist tradition, we have a representation of this quest in the form of a legend. The legend tells us that in his early years, his youth, the Bodhisattva didn't have any idea that living beings are subject to old age, sickness, and death. He grew up in a kind of blissful ignorance, thinking that everybody lives forever. Till one day, out of curiosity, he wanted to take a ride outside the palace. And though his father tried to prevent him, he went out. And on this journey, he discovered an old man. The next day he went out again and stumbled upon a sick man lying on the ground, wallowing in his own vomit and urine. The third day he went out again and came upon a funeral procession, men bearing a corpse to the cremation ground. And each time he had to ask his chariot driver, "What is that?" And the driver has to explain to him, "That's an old man. That's a sick man. That's a corpse." And he even then has to ask, "What is an old man? What is a sick man? What is a corpse?" As though he didn't know this before. But we can see this story as being, you might call it, a charming legend that presents symbolically what in reality would have been a psychological process. This is the process that the Bodhisattva went through probably in his late 20s, since the texts say that he gave up the household life at the age of 29. And in the early suttas, we don't find an account of that Buddha legend, but we can see that the reality underlying that legend is this psychological awakening to the facts of old age, sickness, and death. And so we can say, perhaps for many of us too, even though as teenagers and young men and women, we knew what old age, sickness, and death were as facts, but it's only when we start to reflect upon this, maybe in our late 20s, early 30s, that we realize I too am subject to old age, sickness, and death. And then this is what arouses within us this urge or need to find some spiritual teaching to bring us out from that morass of aging, sickness, and death. Okay, the story related in the 26th discourse of the Majjhima Nikaya continues by showing that the Bodhisattva, when he leaves the palace, well, he undertakes action on that discovery by, as a young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life, he then shaves off his hair and his beard and puts on the ochre robe and goes into homelessness in India during that period. And even today, those who want to undertake this quest for enlightenment and liberation leave the household life and become ascetics, wanderers, sannyasis, wearing an ochre robe or a saffron robe, usually with the shave head shaved, or sometimes they will let the hair and beard grow without shaving. Okay, then when he goes forth, the body, when he renounces the household life, the bodhisattva doesn't immediately try to find a way to enlightenment on his own. But the texts show us that he becomes an apprentice, a disciple, of two of the leading meditation masters of the period. The first one he approaches is Alara Kalama. He learns the teaching from Alara Kalama, then he practices it, and by practicing Alara's teaching, very soon he realizes the same level of attainment that Alara Kalama himself had achieved. This level of attainment is called the stage, the base of nothingness. This is a very high level of samadhi, concentration of mind, mental unification. Then he comes to Alara and reports his experience, and Alara Kalama is very pleased that his disciple has made such fast progress and invites him to share his seat as the teacher and leader of this community of spiritual seekers. But here comes the surprise that even though the Bodhisattva is given such a high honor, a special honor, he doesn't accept the offer. And why is this? We find the answer at the end of paragraph 15, that it occurs to him that this Dhamma taught by Alara Kalama does not lead to disenchantment with the pleasures of the world. It does not lead to dispassion, to the cessation of greed, hatred, and ignorance. It does not lead to real peace, unshakable peace, to the direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nirvana. But it leads only to rebirth in one of these very high planes of existence called the plane or base of nothingness. This is a very high level of achievement, a very high level of rebirth. And when you're reborn there, you dwell there for thousands of aeons. World systems at the material level will arise, perish, arise, perish. But one remains in this plane of nothingness, the mind absorbed in it, in a state of perfect equanimity. For this incalculable period of time. But that long, long period of time eventually comes to an end. Then one has to fall away from that realm and take rebirth elsewhere. And so the Bodhisattva realized this, and therefore he turned away from Alara Kalama and he went seeking elsewhere. He next went to another teacher whose name was Uddaka Ramaputta, and he became a disciple of Uddaka Ramaputta and lived the meditative life under Uddaka. He learned the teaching of Uddaka and he practiced that teaching and realized the highest stage of that teaching, which Uddaka himself had not attained. Uddaka's last name is Ramaputta, which means the son of Rama. And it seems that his father was the original founder of that religious community, and Rama had reached this very high level of samadhi. And Rama had taught it to the others, but nobody in that community had attained it as yet. Even his son, Uttaka Ramaputta, was able to teach the practice that led to that attainment, even though he himself had not achieved it. And so when the Bodhisattva reached that attainment, Rama didn't become upset or envious and think, how can this newcomer surpass me, even when I'm Rama's own son? But Uttaka thought, let me assign to the Bodhisattva the task of leading this community. I will step down and take second place. I will make the Bodhisattva the leader, the teacher of our spiritual community. But again, the Bodhisattva did not accept that offer. And this time he reflects in paragraph 17, he thinks, this Uttaka Ramaputta, my fellow monk, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me this Dharma, his teaching, does not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, or nirvana, but it leads only to rebirth in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This is, in the Buddhist picture of the world, the highest level of rebirth possible in the conditioned universe. And when one is reborn into this realm, one lives there for even a longer time than when one is reborn in the base of nothingness. One can live there for tens of thousands of aeons. But the Bodhisattva realized, if one is reborn there, eventually that long life comes to an end. And then one has to be reborn elsewhere. And so he became disenchanted with that teaching and left it behind. And now the sutta tells us that he went off and discovered a very nice area at Uruvela, where he settled down and then began his striving. And then the text immediately fast forwards us to the point where he attains Nibbana. And then he states that as somebody who's subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, I attained Nibbana, which is the unborn, unaging, ailing, deathless, supreme security from bondage. And so it takes us directly to his attainment of liberation. But now, if you have come across the story of the Buddha before and you read the sutta, you realize that some things are missing from it. And the first thing, important thing that's missing, what do you think is missing?
What he did.
Well, what he did, but specifically what he did according to the traditional story of the life of the Buddha. Yeah. I'm not thinking of that. Even before that, is supposed to have happened on the night of the enlightenment, but before that took place, what happened? Well, this is later.
It's the self-mortification.
Exactly. It's the long period of the self-mortification, for the undertaking of the ascetic practices. And we find this part of the Buddha story in the old texts, in the other sutta that I selected to give us an account of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment. This is the 36th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Maha Satchika Sutta, the longer discourse to the debater named Satchika. And here the Buddha begins the story in the same way. Then curiously we come to a passage here on page 60, paragraph 17, where we encounter three similes. And it strikes me that these similes have gotten into the wrong place in the sutta, even though they're in other versions of the sutta that have come in through other traditions, like in the Chinese version of the sutta coming through another school. The similes are in the same place. But, okay, this is the point of the similes. We can just go through them. The first simile tells us if somebody has, you see, in those days, if you wanted to make a fire, you didn't take out a pack of matches or a cigarette lighter and light it. It was difficult to make a fire in ancient times. One had to use a pair of fire sticks, rubbing sticks together until they create a spark, and then one transfers that spark to some combustible material. Okay, if somebody takes an upper fire stick and then he finds a wet, sappy piece of wood immersed in water and takes it out and rubs them together, then he can't create a fire. Okay, then the Buddha says, this is like ascetics and Brahmins who are still physically engaged in sensual pleasures. They don't give up sensual enjoyment. But if they start to undertake painful austerities, so that they are subjecting themselves to extremely painful feelings, they can't achieve enlightenment. The second simile, see, in this simile, the piece of water, the piece of wood immersed in the water, that is like engaging in sensual enjoyments, especially sexual pleasure. And then rubbing the sticks together, that is like undertaking the austerities. Well, maybe it isn't, because then it ruins the simile. Okay, in the second simile, we have a wet piece of wood, sappy piece of wood, but it's on dry land. And then the man comes with a fire stick and tries to create the fire, but the spark won't arise and he can't create the fire. This is like ascetics and Brahmins who renounce indulgence in sensual pleasures, but they still have sensual desire, sensual craving within them. They have not overcome that within them. That even if they feel painful, even if they practice these ascetic practices and they feel painful feelings, they're still not able to achieve enlightenment, because that sensual desire and sensual craving within, that is the obstacle to enlightenment. But in the third simile, we have a piece of dry wood lying on dry land, and then a man comes with a fire stick and rubs it together, and then he's able to create the spark and to produce fire. And this represents those ascetics and Brahmins who withdraw from bodily indulgence and sensual pleasures, and who succeed in suppressing the craving for sense pleasures within, then, he says, whether those ascetics undertake painful austerities or whether they don't undergo these austerities, they are capable of reaching supreme enlightenment. So the point of these similes seems to be that austerities or the self-mortification is unnecessary for achieving enlightenment. Isn't that the case? But after reflecting on these similes, then the Bodhisattva starts to practice self-mortification. It seems to me self-contradictory. It makes better sense, if I might say so, to take that whole passage and to put it at paragraph 30, as we'll see. Okay, beginning on paragraph 20, the Bodhisattva starts to describe the different extreme practices, the painful practices to which he subjected himself. These must have come after he left Alara and Uddaka Ramaputta and set out on his own. Okay, he undertakes these austerities, he starts reducing, in paragraph 28, he reduces his intake of food, and then his body becomes so emaciated that it's just like, almost reduced to skin and bones. Maybe some of you have seen the famous statue of the Bodhisattva from the Gandhara period. I think it's preserved in Pakistan now. It shows the Bodhisattva just like a skeleton covered with skin, sitting cross-legged, but he still has the distinctive hair like a Buddha. Okay, he says that he now, I'm in paragraph 30, he realizes that he's carried these ascetic practices through to a degree that nobody else has ever carried them. And yet, he finds that they do not lead to any kind of superior distinction in knowledge and vision or to enlightenment. And it seems to me that the proper place for those similes of the pieces of firewood would be here, because now he's realizing that self-mortification is unnecessary, in fact that it's useless. Okay, and now he asks himself the question whether there can be another path to enlightenment. And then a memory comes to him of an event that took place when he was a child. Or some versions of the story tell us when he was an adolescent. One day, it was a tradition in that part of India, every year at the beginning of the planting season, to have a festival for the first plowing of the ground. And so his father brought him to the plowing festival. And while the elders were conducting the plowing festival, the young boy sat in the shade of a rose apple tree. And while he was sitting there, he started just mindfully attending to his breathing. And then very quickly, he entered into a super state, an exalted state of consciousness, which later comes to be called the first jhana, the first meditative absorption. At the time, he didn't know what to make of that state. But now, the question comes to him, could this be the way to enlightenment? And as soon as that question comes to him, he comes to the realization, this is indeed the path to enlightenment. But in answering the question in this way, he's in a sense revolutionizing the understanding of the spiritual quest in India of that period. Because during that period, it was commonly believed that the way to enlightenment is through painful ascetic practices. And so all of the ascetics, when they would enter the homeless life, would subject themselves to long fasts, to different types of self-mortification, because it was the dominant idea was that pain and self-affliction is the way to liberation. But now the Bodhisattva is realizing that the way to liberation should be a happy path, a pleasant path. And so here the text says that he starts to eat solid food again to regain his strength. Then there were 5 monks who were staying close to him and serving him. And when these 5 ascetics saw him taking solid food, gaining his strength again, they became disenchanted with him. They thought that he had returned to a life of luxury, and they abandoned him. And so now he's alone and begins to meditate. The developed story of the Buddha tells us that he was sitting under a tree, which is called the Bodhi tree. And then on this night, as he was sitting there, Mara, the evil one, comes to him and tries to tempt him with sense pleasures, tempt him with the prospect of going back to his hometown and becoming the ruler of the country. Then Mara tries to frighten him away from the seat under the Bodhi tree. These aspects of the classical Buddha story we don't yet find quite in that form in the early suttas. Though we do have the story of the Buddha's confrontation with Mara in a work called the Sutta Nipata. But it's laid out in a poetic form as a kind of ballad. This story that we have here tells us simply that the Bodhisattva attained the 4 jhanas, the 4 higher meditative absorptions, and then he attained the threefold knowledge, the knowledge of his past births, the knowledge of the arising and passing away of other sentient beings. And then in the last watch of the night, he attained the knowledge or discovery of the 4 Noble Truths. And with that discovery of the 4 Noble Truths, then his mind was liberated from all of the barriers. And he became the Buddha. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there are any questions. Yes, please.
I find it very interesting in the beginning that when you're speaking, it's the Buddha, the story of the beginning of the Buddha seems very along the same lines as Christ, the birth of Jesus Christ,
and also,
as you just said, with the confrontation with Mara, much like Christ with Satan.
Yeah,
there
are similarities. Yeah, there's been some speculation that there could have been some Buddhistic influence on the formation of the Gospels and the New Testament.
It's a matter of like who came first. Christ or Buddha?
Oh, it's definitely known that the Buddha came first. The Buddha is, say, 5th century BC. So it's also possible that these stories developed independently because these just seem to be natural features of the human mind in first creating the story of a great exalted being. It's almost a necessity that there has to be some miracle or wondrous events accompanying the birth. And then naturally, I think there comes a period of deep inner struggle which will be depicted externally as a confrontation between the future spiritual master and the forces of evil that are now seen as outside him, trying to tempt him and pull him away from that path.
Will you be going into the paramitas later on?
I'm not going into the paramitas because this text is focusing on the early suttas.
I have a question about the definition of bodhisattva.
Yeah.
In the art world today, we hear that bodhisattva is someone who could have attained enlightenment but heard the crying of the masses and so chose to come down again. Is that a modern interpretation?
I say that's not really so much a modern interpretation. But what we find in the very early form of the development of the bodhisattva concept there's a classical story about how the person who became the Buddha Gautama entered upon his bodhisattva career. This goes back 27 previous Buddhas to a Buddha called Dipankara, which is supposed to be in a world system so many thousands and thousands of kalpas before the present time. At that time, there was a Buddha has arisen in the world. His name was Dipankara. And the being who was to become what we call our bodhisattva was then an ascetic by the name of Sumedha. And he was living in the mountains, meditating. Then one day when he had gone down for begging for alms, he heard a report that he saw that the whole city was being decorated. And he heard a report, he asked, why is the city being decorated? And people told him, the Buddha Dipankara, together with his Sangha, his order, is due to arrive in this city, and we're preparing the city to welcome him. Then when he heard the word Buddha, he became ecstatic and delighted. Then he said, can I help with the preparations too? And then they told him to prepare a certain muddy road, to clean the muddy road and fill it in with sand. And while he was doing this, then the Buddha and his Sangha comes along the road. Then when this being Sumedha, this ascetic Sumedha, sees the Buddha, then he becomes so impressed by the Buddha that he lies his body down, he lays his body down along the road because he hasn't finished filling it in. So he lies down in the mud and he offers his body for the Buddha to walk upon. And while he's lying there, then the idea comes to him that if I wanted right now, I have the faculties needed to achieve liberation, to become an arahant. But I'm so impressed by the figure of the Buddha that I too wish to become a Buddha at some time in the future. And so he forms this wish in his mind, this aspiration. Then the Buddha is standing just right next to him and looks down at him. And then the Buddha is able to read his mind and know that he's formed that aspiration. And then the Buddha gives him the prediction or prophecy that in the future, after so many thousands of aeons, you will become a Buddha by the name of Gautama. And other predicts some other things for him. Then it's at that point that this being becomes a bodhisattva. And then he has to start undertaking the fulfillment or practice of the paramitas. And then from that, the idea develops that a bodhisattva, at least the higher bodhisattvas, are beings who have the wisdom developed, sufficient wisdom to attain liberation, to attain enlightenment, but as disciples of the Buddha. But they don't take that option, but continue to practice the paramitas over incalculable periods in order to become Buddhas in the future, those who will discover the lost path to enlightenment and then establish it in the world. Yes, please, here. I think it's good to speak in the microphone.
I just wanted to understand the five advocates, and I would appreciate if you could sort of walk through that.
As I mentioned last week, at this point I just want to mention them and to give the names. I don't want to go into an explanation of them now, because there'll be later in this course we're going to go into the five aggregates in detail. So if you want to read in advance, you can just jump ahead to the paragraph called Shining the Light of Wisdom, and you read the introduction to that. That will give more explanation of the five aggregates.
It may be a function of my clinging, but I always had trouble with the aim to not be reborn, of that being necessary to enlightenment.
Yeah.
Even today, I'm thinking, well, what if all these Buddhas were being reborn as Buddhas? Wouldn't that be better for the world? So I'd like to understand that part of it a little better.
Yeah, well, in Indian spirituality, in the period in which the Buddha was teaching, you could say the aim is to achieve liberation from birth, aging, and death. And so in order to, let's say, fulfill that requirement of Indian spirituality, the being who's become a Buddha has to break free from the bonds of birth, aging, and death. If he keeps on being reborn, then it will seem to people that he's still subject to the bondage of birth and death. Of course, in later Buddhism, the idea develops that a Buddha becomes free from birth, aging, and death, but is still able, from the domain of liberation, to project, say, forms of himself into birth and death in order to provide assistance to others. Okay, maybe I'll take one more question, then because I want to continue with the rest of the chapter.
And the aspiration brings to mind a question my son has asked me lately. How do you differentiate, or can you differentiate, between aspiration, such as you've just outlined, and desire, clinging to an aggregate?
Okay, what is called desire, clinging, is usually based on, I think the simplest word to use is something that's selfish, something that brings gratification of the ego, the false sense of identity. Whereas I would say an aspiration is the desire to achieve some higher spiritual state, which will either be a stage on the way to the dissolution of the ego, or the actual state of dissolution itself, the complete freedom from the bonds of the ego. Just trying to put it very concisely. Okay, if there's one, I still have one hand here. If I could answer that question briefly, I'll do so. Use the microphone, please.
it seems very clear by reading this that he's saying that how he came to enlightenment was through the Dhammas.
Yeah.
So there are there are numerous teachers that can show us, that they claim that they can show us how to go through these Dhammas. So in your experience, do you see that this is what our meditative experience in the practice of meditation, of everyday practice, we should be leaning towards getting these Dhamma states?
This is a question which I would say pertains now to a later stage in the unfolding of this book. So I'm going to say just very briefly that as the Buddhist tradition, or even in the early Buddhist texts, we could see different approaches to the attainment of even the first stage of enlightenment. So even though we say the classical form of the complete path includes the four jhanas, but I would say within this, and there's no sutta which says definitely that it's possible to achieve enlightenment without the jhanas, but different presentations of the path emerge even within the early texts, and some seem to indicate at least the possibility of attaining the first or second stages of the four stages of enlightenment without the jhanas. Yeah. I think it's good, Jen, if you can keep that group out until we finish the class. Okay. Okay, I want to go on and try to conclude this chapter. Okay, now on page 67, we have a sutta called The Ancient City, which again gives us another focus on the Buddha's experience of enlightenment. The account that we come in, that we read in Sutta number 36, Majjhima 36, doesn't really explain what the Buddha investigated immediately before his enlightenment. What was it that he discovered? And this sutta shows us that what he discovered is essential realization, the realization that led up to the enlightenment, was the discovery of the chain of dependent origination. At this point, I'm not going to go into an explanation of the chain of dependent origination. I just included this text here. In order to show what the Buddha discovered, then the explanation of dependent origination will come later, again in the chapter on wisdom. It will be taken in the second half of the course, so in order to get detailed explanation, you have to come back for that. But what's important and interesting in this passage is that the Bodhisattva, or the Buddha, on page 69, compares his discovery of the way to enlightenment to a man wandering through a forest who discovers an ancient road leading to an ancient city. This would be a road which has been completely covered up by the jungle, somewhat like the roads leading to Angkor Wat in Cambodia, or earlier it would have been like the road leading to Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka before it was rediscovered in the 19th century, covered up with jungle. And then he follows this road and sees that it comes to an ancient city. And then he informs the king of this, and then the king renovates that city so many people can live in it. Okay, this is like the Buddha says, in the same way I saw the ancient path, the ancient road traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past, the Sammasambuddhas of the past, And this road is the Noble Eightfold Path. And then by following that path, the Buddha has discovered or realized dependent origination. And then he explains them, proclaims them to the monks, the nuns, the male lay followers, and the female lay followers. And so this text supports the idea that I mentioned earlier, that the Buddha is not a unique figure in history, at least from the standpoint of the early texts, but he's the successor of the earlier perfectly enlightened Buddhas, the one who discovers the same things that they discover and who opens up the same path that they had opened up. Okay, now with section 4 of this chapter, we come to a key phase in the life of the Buddha. Now he's the enlightened one, he's achieved the realization for himself. And we see him sitting on the seat of enlightenment, reflecting. And first he reflects on the Dhamma, the truth that he has discovered. And what is this truth? We can see that it is dependent origination and nirvana, which is called the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all the upadhi, all of the acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation. Then he raises in his own mind the question, should I try to share my realization with others? Should I try to convey to them the Dhamma that I have discovered? And when he first ponders that question, it occurs to him that this Dhamma that he's found is very deep and difficult to understand. Whereas human beings are involved in all sorts of attachments and clinging. And so it's going to be impossible to convey this truth to others. And thus he says, my mind inclined to inaction, just to staying quietly, rather than to going out and to undertake that burdensome task of teaching the Dhamma. Okay, when this thought arises in the mind of the Buddha, then a being called Brahma Sahampati, this is a deity living in one of the higher celestial realms, he's sort of looking down, following the course of the Buddha's thoughts, and when he sees that the Buddha has decided not to teach the Dhamma, he becomes anxious and disturbed. And so he disappears from the Brahma world, and he appears before the Buddha. Like a good gentleman, he arranges his robe in the proper way. Then he bows down in front of the Buddha. Because even though the Buddha is a human being, but as an enlightened one, he's superior even to the deities. And so he bows down to the Buddha and he pleads with the Buddha, please teach the Dhamma. There are those with little dust in their eyes who would understand the Dhamma. And if you don't teach it, they're going to be lost. They will perish. Then Brahma reinforces his point with beautiful verses. Again, in appealing to the Buddha to teach the Dhamma. Then when the Buddha hears Brahma's request, then he says, out of compassion, I'm in paragraph 21, out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. This is, he has a special kind of vision by which he can understand the minds of other living beings, see deeply into their most deeply buried thoughts, their capacities, their potentials. And then he sees that human beings are like lotus flowers in a pond. Some are still at the bottom of a pond, covered over with dirt, with mud and with water. Others are like lotus flowers who are growing halfway through the pond. And then others are like lotuses that have emerged from the pond. Their buds have come up over the edge of the water, and they're just waiting for the light of the sun in order to open and display their beauty and to give off their lovely fragrance. Those who are above the surface of the water, those are like the people with little dust in their eyes, with sharp faculties, with good qualities, will be easy to teach. And so then the Buddha replies to Brahmasahampati. He says, "Open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith." Thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not speak the subtle and sublime Dhamma. This passage raises the interesting question that what people often ask, and I had struggled with this question in my early days as a Buddhist. If the Buddha was really compassionate, why didn't he go out and teach on his own? Why did he decide to keep quiet and need somebody else to come down and beg him to teach? The way I understand this passage, at one level it might be understood as a kind of, shall I put in quotation marks, historical truth, even though historians of ancient India won't agree that there are beings in heavenly worlds that can come down to speak to us. But if there are such beings, and there's really a Buddha in the world, why shouldn't a being come down and speak to the Buddha? But also I would see this as having this passage as having a somewhat symbolic function. It shows that the Buddha, through his wisdom, has completely transcended the world. He's now, in a sense, beyond the world. But in order for that compassion to open up, awaken, and expand, the world has to appeal to him to come forth and teach. And so Brahmasahampati, even though he's a deity, he's still a sentient being, still part of the world. He too is still bound up in the cycle of samsara. And so in a sense he's like the spokesperson for the world, who's come to the Buddha and appeals to him to teach. And that appeal is what arouses or awakens the Buddha's compassion. And then this shows what I call, first we could think of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment, the awakening of wisdom, call it the ascending phase of the quest for enlightenment. It's moving from the world upwards to the transcendence of the world. Then this passage where the Buddha looks out upon the world and sees beings like similar to lotus flowers, then makes the decision to teach. This I would call the descending movement of enlightenment, whereby from the peak of transcendence, one moves back down in the world, no longer in bondage to it, no longer capable of being soiled or defiled by the world, but one comes back into the world in order to communicate, to convey the Dhamma to others. And this passage, in a way, serves almost like a template or a paradigm that characterizes the experience of many teachers in the Buddhist tradition. In their early phase, they go off into solitude to meditate in order to achieve some higher realization. Then after they achieve it, or at least when they achieve some spiritual progress, at a certain point, others will start requesting them to teach, or on their own initiative, they will begin to teach, and then they come back and begin to teach and guide others. Okay, then the Buddha now raises in his mind the question who he should teach. First, he thinks of his earlier teachers. This is to express his gratitude to earlier teachers. He thinks of Alara Kalama. But then, with his divine eye, he realizes that Alara died 1 week ago. Then he thinks of Uddaka Ramaputta, but he realizes that Uddaka Ramaputta passed away the day before. Then he thinks of the five ascetics who had earlier served him, and then he realizes that they would be good receptacles for the teaching. And then he recognizes that the five ascetics are now dwelling near the city of Benares in the deer park. And so he sets off to walk from Bodh Gaya, the seat of the enlightenment, the site of the enlightenment, to the deer park near Benares. As he's walking, he meets another ascetic and he has an exchange with him. Then he comes to the deer park. When he arrives, the five ascetics see him coming in the distance, and they say, they make a pact amongst them. Here comes that ascetic Gotama, now quite full and plump, indulging himself, enjoying himself, eating as much as he wants. We are still like thin as rickets. So we're not going to serve him. If he wants, he can join us, but none of us should get up and greet him or give him the courtesies, since he's not our teacher anymore. And so as the Buddha approached, something happened in the five ascetics, even though they're still saying we shouldn't serve him, we shouldn't go out to greet him, but they get up and go out to greet him. And one takes his alms bowl, another takes his extra robe, another prepares a seat for him. But they still speak to him. They call him Abhuso. Abhuso is an address used amongst equals. Here it's translated friend. It means something a little more than friend, like reverend, but it's not a proper term of veneration. And so the Buddha now says to them, don't address me. He says, I am the Tathagata, the one who has realized the truth. So don't address me as Abhuso, as friend. I am now an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened Buddha. And if you will listen to me, I will teach you the path that I have discovered. And then you too will be able to achieve the highest goal. But then the five ascetics complain, and they say that you couldn't achieve the goal when you were practicing asceticism. How could you achieve it now that you're living a life of luxury? The Buddha says, I'm not leading a life of luxury. You misunderstand. Let me teach you and you will realize the goal. Three times this exchange goes on. Three times the monks refuse to accept his claim. Then, I'm in paragraph 28, the Buddha uses a different approach. He says, have you ever heard me speak to you like this before? And they all know that he's an honorable person, one who is very sincere, direct, and upright. And so they realize that he would not claim to be enlightened if he was not in fact enlightenment. And so now they say to him, not no abuso, but they say no bhante, no venerable sir. This means that they've now accepted his claim. They're now regarding him as the perfectly enlightened one. Okay, and then after they accept his claim, he proceeds to teach them. And the teaching that he's going to give them is the teaching of the first discourse, which I've included here, but I'm not going to explain it at this point. Again, this will come in the section on wisdom. But when the Buddha gives them the first discourse on the Four Noble Truths and other instructions, then they begin to practice on their own, guided by the Buddha. And within a short time, a few weeks, they also achieve the highest goal. According to this text, they attain the unborn, unaging, unailing, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Okay, now I'll conclude the lecture at this point. And now if there are any questions, I'll let us go up until 11:15. Please feel welcome to ask them. Yes, we should have the microphone.
It's just a simple question. The five that attained, as I understand it, they attained the same enlightenment as the Buddha. Would they be considered Buddhas as well?
Okay, this is a good question. Okay, now the way the word Buddha comes to be used in the text, especially the expression Sammasambuddha, perfectly, completely enlightened one, the word Sammasambuddha is used uniquely for a person who on his own, without any teaching or guidance, discovers the lost path to enlightenment and then teaches it to the world. Okay, then those who practice the path under the guidance of the Buddha, or who practice the path made known by the Buddha, come to be called, one says that they become Buddha in the sense of being awakened, or even Sambuddha, fully awakened. And their attainment is called Sambodhi, full enlightenment. But it's not the same degree of full enlightenment as a Sammasambuddha. A Sammasambuddha has to discover this path that is lost. And to do so, or when he does so, he discovers this path in all of its different dimensions, in all of its ramifications. And along with his attainment of enlightenment, he gains certain faculties that enable him to function as a world teacher. These include the ability to know immediately the thoughts of others in others' minds, to know their faculties, to know what kind of qualities have been developed in earlier lives, what virtues are outstanding in them, what problems or defects are quite obstructive within them. And so the Buddha can teach the path in all of its diversity, and when he's ever he's teaching, he can present the path in the way that's precisely attuned to the mental capacities of the person getting the instruction. Whereas others who reach enlightenment under his guidance will have sometimes a broad understanding of the path, sometimes a very specialized one that's suitable for themselves, but they don't achieve all of these special qualities that are achieved by a Sammasambuddha.
Is there some significance to the five ascetics not recognizing the Buddha, and he has to proclaim his enlightenment as if it wasn't apparent?
Yeah, I think the significance is that they are still adhering to the old idea that the way to enlightenment is through painful austerities. And so this exchange that takes place here has a way of almost heightening, preparing the way for the declaration that there is a new way, a real way to enlightenment, which is not the way of self-mortification. And then we see in the first discourse, when the Buddha opens the discourse, he explains the two extremes that should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. One is indulgence in sense pleasures, which is rather axiomatic for a renunciant. But the other extreme is the way of self-mortification, which the Buddha says is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Then the Buddha is going to proclaim the way that he has discovered, which leads to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path. So I think that scene, in a way, prepares the ground for the declaration, the first enunciation of the Noble Eightfold Path as the middle way. Another question?
My question came from Sutta 26. When the text describes the self-mortification practice, the Bodhisattva mantra, it says that the Buddha was exhausted by the painful striving, but such painful feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain.
Yeah.
I want to know what made the Buddha capable of doing that. Was it because of his previous meditative practice, or is this a strong will? Because as an ordinary person, an unenlightened one, I want to know how I can do that.
I would have to speculate, since I don't think the text gives a quite unequivocal answer to that question. But I would say this is probably a combination of both factors. I would say that it's through his probably previous practices over earlier lives as a bodhisattva that he's developed the strength of mind not to be shaken by painful feeling. And then it could be through his earlier meditative practices in that life under his earlier teachers. He had already achieved these high formless stages of meditative absorption. Though he still experienced, when he practiced the self-mortification, he still experienced the painful feeling. But that painful feeling didn't disturb him. That was probably due to the strength of will.
During the intermediate state, between rebirth appear. Apparently, it could not be recorded in early texts. Otherwise, the Buddha could have been able to teach his two previous teachers who just passed away.
I see. In the early texts, we don't meet any explicit account of beings in the human world making contact with beings, let's say, in an intermediate state of existence. And now, this is an important point. These two former teachers, because of their meditative practices, have been reborn in the formless realm. This is the Arupa Loka. In the formless realm, one doesn't have a physical body, and one doesn't have physical sense faculties, including the ear. One doesn't have an ear. And so without an ear, one cannot hear teachings. And in that way, the Buddha would not be able to contact them in the formless realm, since they don't have bodies, they don't have ears. The Buddha is able, we see sometimes in his later ministry, he's able to go to the Brahma world and to speak to the Brahmas, the divinities in the Brahma world, because they have bodies, they have ears, and so he can teach them. But not the beings in the Arupa world, the formless realm. Okay, I'm going to have to stop here. And now, two announcements I want to make. One is, some people might not be aware of it, but this course is actually based on this book called In the Buddha's Words. And so each week before the class, I recommend that you read the chapter on which that class will be based, rather than just come into the class cold without any previous reading. Because to fully benefit from the course, you should do the reading which the course is intended to elucidate. And so the next chapter will be the chapter called Approaching the Dhamma. That's chapter 3. And the next class will be not next Saturday, the Saturday after that, October 20th. The second announcement, I heard some people are interested in having a discussion amongst themselves after my class. Maybe you take a little break and then you can have a discussion period. So please go ahead and do so. Henry Chang, he will be the leader of the discussion group. And where are you going to have the discussion? To have it here.
Yeah, I as a variable legal body suggests that after the class, because variable will leave, but if people are interested, and then we could suggest we can form a small study group for another period of time, like half an hour or 1 hour, for the people to talk with each other, to continue the discussion, and that will be great beneficial to the people who want to reflect. So, yeah.
Okay, so now we'll end with the sharing of the merits.
Akasata chabumata deva naga mahetika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahetika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mang param. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. I'll do it a little shorter. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhava rupadaya avici hetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin.
Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. Please rise. Bows to the Buddha. First bow. Second bow. Third bow. Bow to the Buddha.